Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views, and interviews with the founders, CEOs, entrepreneurs, clinicians, and investors that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners of the show will know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech business myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc's Healthy Heart Check allows you in 10 minutes to give yourself a full health check at home with instant results, a full cholesterol panel, your official heart age, all instantly through your smartphone. And that's something that's rolling out across the NHS and across pharmacies as we speak. So if you're interested in what is going on with us at PocDoc, please head to pocdoc.co. That's PocDoc.co. And thanks as ever to PocDoc for the support in putting on the show. Then, as ever, let's just say a quick thank you to everyone who's listening live on the amazing UK Health Radio. Really appreciate the live platform as ever. There's loads of other presenters doing really great shows, so feel free to check out that content as well. Thank you if you're listening on any of the podcast channels or watching on YouTube, and finally watching any of the clips that we put out on my Instagram, which is at Steve Roost. It's great to have you with us. It's amazing that we have listeners in over 50 different countries every month tuning in. We really appreciate you guys being part of the community. Thank you very much. So the last show that we did with Dr. Sarah Kiat was amazing. So Dr. Sarah told her story of how she's ended up being the nation's TB doctor, in effect. She's the doctor, the TB doctor on This Morning, how she was a GP and then just through serendipity, in effect, has become the face of doctoring on TV. It's an incredible journey, incredible story. And we delved into all kinds of different things, including the importance of accurate, correct, clinically sound advice about all aspects of health, but particularly women's reproductive health, which is why she wrote her book on pregnancy. So if that is your bag and you're interested in that, I would recommend you check out the show that we did with Dr. Sarah Kiat. On today's show, actually, which is our last live show before Christmas, which is coming up, we're continuing our run of really incredible, inspirational people with my guest today, which is Lottie White, or who is Lottie White, the CEO and co-founder of MyoMaster. Now, MyoMaster is the fastest growing health business of its kind in the UK. It's a sports recovery business, does all kinds of different things from ice baths through to massage guns. Full disclosure, I actually bought, oh no, I probably shouldn't say this. I'm not going to say what it is, just in case my wife's listening. But I actually bought something off of MyoMaster today for Christmas. So, for those of you that may be fans of Dragon's Den, Lottie is a veteran of Dragon's Den, and she sort of got quite a bit of notoriety about putting Stephen Bartlett in his place about a couple of things. And finally, Lottie's been really open on her platforms around the difficulties and struggling of balancing running a business, running a really successful business that's exploding, and having a family, running a family. So there's quite a lot to discuss. Lottie, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, I'm good. I'm okay. Good. I'm on the countdown to Christmas, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I can imagine. Are you guys going to take time off, or like what happens? Because what happens?
I've shutting the office for 2 weeks, so the whole team's going to have a rest. And Joe and I and our family are heading to Sri Lanka for a couple of weeks. So,
oh, very nice.
Yeah, we've had a phenomenal year, which I'm sure we'll get into, and we've grown really rapidly, and we do things with a really lean team, so everybody is knackered and overdue a rest, basically.
Yeah, but is this like the busiest ever time now, or is it not that seasonal?
Oh, Black Friday is big for us. We had a strong, really big November. And then January is really big again because of everyone getting back into their fitness, their health goals, etc. So it's a little bit of a lull. We can take a bit of a rest in between. Yeah.
Cool. Well, there's quite a lot I want to get into across all different type of things. But I want to kind of start with, what was your journey like? So I know that you began your career in and around the PR and comm space, I believe, in and around that space. And at what point did you, come up with the idea? I guess not the idea, but at what point did you realize that you might want to go off and do something entrepreneurial? Let's start there. And then that will then evolve into the business.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny because people ask me all the time, like, did you always have a desire? You know, some people are like the people that sold sweets at school when they were 13 and they've got that like tuck shop story.
Yeah.
I really didn't have that. In fact, when I was growing up, my grandparents had a tea rooms in Folkestone, and I spent a lot of time there when I was younger, and I resented it deeply. And I watched them work from 5 a.m. until 8, 9 o'clock at night, every day of the week it was open. And it was relentless in terms of how much hard work it was. And I really couldn't think of anything worse than starting my own business. Like, it was awful. And I couldn't really understand why anyone would want that kind of commitment.
Right.
And when I came out of university, I kind of fell into a job in PR and advertising. And my boss at the job said, you know, you're going to be an entrepreneur. And I was like, it's not for me. Like, I'm not interested. I want to be the CEO of somebody else's company. Right. So I did always want to be a boss, but not for myself.
Okay. And why was it that person said, I think you're going to be an entrepreneur? Like,
so him and I were very close. He was CEO of the company that I started working at. He's actually the youngest ever FTSE 100 CEO. He's a kind of remarkable guy.
Wow.
And he was my mentor, and he gave me a lot of opportunities. And I was very, you know, they have this saying, intrapreneurs, where you have entrepreneurs within a bigger organization. I guess that's what I was. I was coming up with new ideas, initiatives, putting them into play, changing the way the business worked. And without realizing it, he was like, you're basically behaving like an entrepreneur, but you're doing it in this business. And I really resisted it because I just... Yeah, it wasn't for me.
You didn't want your own team.
I didn't want to do it, yeah.
and then at what point did that like shift?
It really was led by the idea rather than, I think, my desire to become an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So training's always been part of my life. I've trained, you know, pretty much every day since I was 5 years old.
In any particular discipline or just?
When I was growing up, I did a lot. I was really into athletics. And I played hockey to quite a high level, and county girls cricket. And I was just super sporty, right, at school.
Okay.
And my brother played for Crystal Palace. And
nice.
Dad was like a Marine. And my mum's like 60. She still trains 7 times a week. Like, we're just that family, right, where sport was our thing.
Yeah.
And as I got older, I was running marathons. And then I got into CrossFit.
Okay.
Probably like more functional fitness training. You might call high rock training now. But when I started.
Yeah. High rocks is the new thing.
It's amazing. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So I was really into sports. And then Joe, my husband, came up with this product because I married an elite athlete, obviously.
Yeah.
He was a professional rugby player and he had an injury and he developed this product. And that was a moment for us where we were like, oh, I think this could be a thing. And so it was led by the product and the need rather than like my desire to start my own thing.
Is it true that the first product was a power drill?
Yes.
Did I read that?
It's that's really true. And I'm amazed that we haven't been sued. Because we sold hundreds of these. And I'm not kidding. They were B&Q drills that we adapted in our spare room.
Right.
And sold at like trade shows and at sort of cycle shows. And people always say, like, I think a lot of people, when they're thinking about starting a business, they get caught up in this idea of like the product's got to be amazing and it's got to be perfect. And I'm a big believer in like launching with your MVP and like the most basic thing you can get out there, go with it.
Yeah.
And see if there's demand or interest in what you're
doing. I totally agree. Like I can't, I mean, in the medical device business, obviously it's regulated, right? So there's more constraints, but history's littered with medical device businesses that never managed to get a product to market because they aim for perfection.
Right.
As opposed to what's functionally.
Starting.
Yeah. Yeah. You get it functional, get it out, learn, iterate, et cetera. So I completely agree. And when you showed up to these trade fairs and like, I'm sure you painted the drills or you did something to them and put a little sticker on them, whatever you did, you know, give or take. But were people like blown away? What was the reaction? Was this at that time, was this like a completely new concept? Or
yeah. So it's essentially a massage gun, right? But it's pre them being a thing. And in fact, one of the reasons we had that prototype for so long was because we were trying to get it made in China and nobody made it because they weren't a thing.
Okay.
And now, like, what, you'd be one phone call away from getting that product developed. And they were trying to charge us like 300 grand for tooling to create the product, and we just didn't have the money. And so I took it to the first trade show. The first trade show I did was the cycle show at the XL. Okay. And I thought, like, how can this go wrong? We took a couple of grand out of my savings, booked a stall, rocked up with my two suitcases full of B&Q drills that we'd adapted. And, you know, nobody stopped or was interested because I think it was like, why is that girl over there trying to sell me a B&Q drill? I think you're in the wrong show, exactly.
I
was sort of getting really dispirited and I was like, this is stupid. Okay. I didn't think this was a great idea. Well, you know, no one cares. And about an hour before the end of the show, I just was like, well, it's kind of now or never. So I stood out in the corridor with two of the drills and just started sort of hijacking people as they walked past, like going up and down their backs.
Yeah.
And the noise was so loud. It's like a 5-deep crowd because people were just so curious. And by the end of the show, we sold out of the we were selling these adapted drills for like 250 quid. Like it wasn't small change, it was like a lot of money.
Yeah. And like, I just find that, I think that's amazing. I love that. I love stories. I love these, like, I always love the origin stories, you know, like the road stories, everyone sort of got them.
Yeah.
That's, and so was that actually the light bulb moment or was there another?
Yeah, I think that was the moment where it went from being, you know, something we'd messed about within our kitchen to like, hang on a second, you know, we might be onto something here.
Okay. And like, that was like the first instance, but that's still quite a long way away from actually starting a company. And making it a thing. Yeah, it's like you know, so how did that transition happen from, oh my gosh, we might be onto something, to like, actually, we're actually in this is a thing?
Yeah, well, we just kept going to trade shows basically. So like,
okay,
this was like just about the 6 months before COVID happened, so sort of end of 2019, start of 2020. And I would just work my job in the week. And then at the weekends, we'd just pack up the van and go to the trade shows. And I just kept selling the drills. And then we kept reinvesting the money and so on and so forth. And then COVID happened. So obviously there were no trade shows. And I had no experience of running a D2C brand, setting up a website. I don't even know if Shopify existed or like it wasn't a thing.
No, it definitely was. It was around, but it wasn't a thing back then.
It wasn't like, oh, I'm starting a D2C brand, I'll set up.
No. It wasn't like shop in a box.
Exactly. So I hired like a designer to build a one-page website that a friend had recommended. And we built this very basic website. And then I hired an agency using my salary to pay all the bills. Wow. And I was like, let's start. Everyone was talking to me about Meta ads and how I had to start doing Meta ads. So we started filmed some ads in our garden and we started working with the ad agency. And I always regret this so much because I'm like, oh my God, if I knew that, you know, what I know now, I would have blown up in COVID. You know, the brands that were actually fitness or wellness brands that were already set up, they exploded, right?
Yeah.
But we did explode in a very small relative way.
Like a great explosion for you guys, but
it was,
not
but
quite.
Yeah, but yeah. It was very minimal. And I'm like, no, God, if that happened now, we'd be not that
like fine. But please, yeah, let's not.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not praying for that. But it, you know, if it came now, then it would be it we'd milk it. We'd be great. It would be amazing. Right. But anyway, and so after that, at the start of 2021. So sort of like mid-COVID, after we'd done that year of seeing how the ads could work, having a bit of a website, I quit my job. And I was like, let's give this thing a go.
Let's have a crack.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, what was the biggest thing that you thought would be a problem, but wasn't actually a problem?
Do you mean in regards to like quitting my job or generally?
Well, anything, just starting it. Because like, there's all these things and fears and conceptions that you have before you do it. And some of them turn out to be true. And some of them turn out, oh my God, I shouldn't have worried about that in the first place.
Hmm. Honestly, I don't know if anything's not been difficult. Just to be totally honest with you, single thing on this journey has been challenging.
Yeah,
I'd love to be more positive, but I can't think of anything.
No. I think it's like, that makes sense. I mean, it is hard and it is difficult. I guess, like, you know, there was definitely some stuff around with us. There was like, I was worried about a particular type of thing, and it turned out that that thing wasn't the thing to actually worry about. It was like,
oh, you mean there was something greater that was,
yeah, yeah. It was like, I thought it was about this, and then it turns out it actually wasn't about that at all.
I get that. I think, was there anything? No, I think I was so naive. I really, you know, I'd had like a really good career, but it was very much in an agency, like a big, it was kind of Mad Men, the agency I worked in. And it was like, it was very, you know, cushioned in a way. There were processes and systems of how you did things, and I got a very nice salary, and I had a PA who knew my coffee order, and like all these things, you know. And it felt hard at the time, but really it wasn't
so hard.
I started doing the company, and I was like, oh my God, I didn't even know how good I had it. That was
awful. I mean, is there any element where like you'd wish you'd go back to that old life or no?
I'm not going to lie, you know. I know, I think this, the entrepreneur, I mean, I'm sure you'll agree, right? Entrepreneurship is glamorized, and there's, even now we're riding high, we've had the best year ever. It's still, I said to my team the other day, I was like, does this ever just become easy? Because it's like, I feel like I'm putting out fires every single day. Things go wrong, and I think you take for granted. I think there's so much to be said for having an amazing career in corporates or in companies where you get an amazing salary, you progress up the ladder, you have holiday, you have sick pay, you know.
You dare, I say, get
maternity
leave.
I'm about to have a baby, and I'm like, nobody's going to pay me for maternity leave. Like, that, all of these things you take for granted, I think. And I think, you know, would I do it again if I knew them what I know now? I'm not actually sure, to be honest.
Well, I say this about this. And so I did a previous venture and now this one. And this was my first sort of like medical clinical one. So my two co-founders are scientists, one of which is my wife, and I'm more of the business commercial person. And thank goodness I was naive about the science.
Exactly. Yeah. It was so much better that way. Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, like, there was just such an element of like, yeah, this is possible. Yeah, we can do this. And like,
but I think you need an element of that, right? You need someone who's like, of course we can do it. Why can't we? You know, you need that. Otherwise, I think you maybe would never get there, you know?
No, that's true. And like, did you have people, so we definitely did, where they were like, because we obviously in this business, there was like quite, we were doing something that was genuinely new, like new innovation, like it had never been done before. Yeah. And there were people like lining up to tell us it was impossible.
So I
I don't know. Did you have a similar experience or no?
I think we had people who were just, you know, people close to us, certainly, who were just a bit like, why are you putting yourself under all this stress? You know, and as we talked about, you know, before we came on, I was had my first child at a very similar sort of timeline.
Yeah.
And so it's like, why are you doing this to yourself? You know, and I was working every weekend, and, you know, I think there's just an element of like, you had it good. What need to go and do this?
Were you like surprised at yourself, given your background, like you said about never having particularly wanted to be an entrepreneur, but like, was there an element of like, I'm not quite sure why I did this, or you were like, no, this is the right thing? Or is it sort of,
yeah,
you know, I think, you know,
I,
what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I think I'm surprised I've ended up here, but when I look back on it in hindsight, it makes sense. Even right. though I didn't understand it, you know, I'm a very, as a person and my personality, I'm very suited to be an entrepreneur. Like I'm very right. much a leader. I come up with ideas all the time. I love to like, I'm very zero to one. I'm like, let's just give it a go and see what happens. I'm a risk taker, yeah. you know, all of those things that probably I was probably made to do this, but I, you know, held off for a long time.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, my job before I did my first venture was in advertising and
content. Oh, really?
Yeah. So
what did you do?
I was on one of these like advertising CEO of the future grad schemes, you know, and I won't mention that it was one of the two global networks and used to work around a series of agencies. Basically, you end up in one of the agencies. And this is just before the financial crash. It was like peak Mad Men.
Yeah.
The end for me was when my boss's boss took me aside in the pub and told me that I had no future in advertising because I worked too hard for a grad. And I was like, and I'm done.
Yeah. I had a few moments like that as well, which were like, I'm not sure this is for me.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure our interests are aligned on this one. Right, so we have to go for our first commercial break. When we come back on, I want to talk about a couple of things. So one of the things that came up when we were looking, or when I was kind of doing my research for the show, was that you were part of the Black Founders Fund run by Google.
Yeah.
Which I really want to get under the skin of, because from what I've read about what you posted about it, it sounds like transformational, not just for you, but for others. So I'd love to get into a little bit of that. We obviously have to touch on Dragon's Den. You've told the story like 10,000 times, but we just have to touch on that. And then we can go on to some other stuff. Because I'd love to hear from you a little bit about like what you think where you think the future is in your sector, as opposed to just Myer Master. We could talk about ice baths as well. So I just came back from Lapland, where we did we were jumping in the frozen lakes and stuff like that. So and the kids as well. So we got them in there. No hypothermia. So anyway, we'll be back in 2 minutes after this break with my guest today, Lottie White, who's the founder of Myer Master. We'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Lottie White, who's the founder of Myer Master. So, Lottie, why don't we switch gears a little bit? I want to talk specifically about the Black Founders Fund, Google Black Founders Fund. So, because I read, I think it was on LinkedIn, on one of your posts around how transformational and important that had been in your journey. So, could you maybe just explain a bit about what it is, how you came to be involved in it, why you think it's so important, and we can kind of take it from there.
Yeah, I came to be involved in it because actually for 2 years, other founders that I knew had been telling me to apply for it. And I didn't apply because I didn't think the company was tech focused enough for Google.
Okay.
And that's a kind of classic example of when we kind of talk ourselves out of something that, you know, could end up being an amazing opportunity. And I ended up applying for it in 2023 last year. And I submitted the application like literally 2 minutes before it was due in at midnight. And I was like, my phone kept cutting out and like, it felt like it really wasn't meant to be because I was like, I had to record a video and all of this stuff.
Right.
Anyway, I think 4,000 companies applied across UK, Europe and Africa. And they selected 40 in total and 10 in the UK.
Okay.
Of which Myer Master was one. And for me, it was really so necessary because I quit my job at the start of 2021. 2021 went quite well. We raised a bit of money. 2022 was a complete disaster. I messed it up and I spent the money too fast. And I just didn't know what I was doing. Right. And then in 2023, we got this investment from Google.
Oh, did it come with them? It came with some investment.
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Aside from the money, the thing that was aside from the money, the thing that was amazing about it was just the kind of I guess getting the thing was a huge like boost for me. It was, It was validation, yeah, that I just, after having had a really tough kind of 12 to 18 months with the business and feeling a lot of doubt around whether I could scale it, it really propelled me on and gave me a lot of belief. So that's one element of it. Secondary, they opened up access to basically everyone in Google.
Right. So
you have access to these incredible brains and incredible minds, which is really helpful. And lastly, and probably the most fundamental thing, the 10 other founders or 9 other founders in the UK are now my best friends, basically.
That's great.
And I think you need you need a tribe. I always say this to people. I'm like, starting a company is a bit like when you first become a parent. It's like there's no point talking to people who don't have kids about, you know, being up at 2 a.m. and how tired you are, because unless you've done it, you just don't get it.
Yeah.
It's hard to understand. And I think it's similar with founders. I think you need to find your tribe of people that you can call when you've been rejected by the 30th investor and you're doubting yourself. And, you know, all of those moments, you need people. And those people have really become my tribe. And so that's really helped me on the journey. It's been really powerful for me.
That's awesome. And just for the sake of everyone listening, because we're a broad church, why did Google feel like it was necessary to do something like this specifically for Black founders?
Yeah, so I think in the UK and US, 0.02% of investment money goes to Black female founders. Right. I don't think it's much higher for Black male founders. I don't think it's much higher, maybe a little bit. But essentially, it's incredibly difficult to raise money, whatever you look like and wherever you come from. Mm-hmm. And then you take the fact that you're from a minority ethnic background, it gets much harder. And then as a female, it's basically impossible. I think 10 people in the UK have managed to raise VC money that are Black female founders in the last 10 years. So the numbers that's a fact. I know that for sure.
No, I'm not challenging. I'm just like, I'm not blowing away. I think it's 11. I heard it was 11. No. What are the structural reasons behind, I mean, other than, like, I guess racism, but what are the other, there must be some structural stuff.
I think the structural reasons are that most of the people who write the checks are white males. That is the ecosystem. And, you know, I don't think a lot of the time it's racism. I think it's just unconscious bias. It's that you give money to people who have similar backgrounds to you, or who you have a point of connection with, or, you know, most investment money comes through networks. So, you know,
people get referred
through their own networks. And so you've got to know the people. And that is a really big barrier for people who come from backgrounds that aren't necessarily connected to those others.
Do you think that there's also like an opportunity issue, as in like Black boys and girls of whatever age, men and women, they're not given the same opportunities to create businesses that could go on and raise money, or is that not so much of an issue?
I think the issue isn't around, and I originally thought the same thing. I thought, you know, perhaps it's actually, because we talk about race and often it's actually much more connected to socioeconomic
challenges.
Yeah. But basically, Black and mixed race women, Black and brown women in the UK are the fastest group of people creating businesses in the UK.
There is that right?
Creating more businesses than Black and brown women in the UK. And so when you know that, and then you know that nobody can raise money, you realize the issue isn't because the businesses aren't there. It's because they just don't have the access. And so I think I think it's really about unconscious bias. And I know that to be true because I have started investing in companies and I only invest in Black and brown founders because that I'm making a positive and conscious choice to do that.
Yeah.
And so you might sit there as a white founder and say, well, that's not fair. In the same way that, you know, as I think if you're someone sitting there with a check, and I think in a way I'm quite lucky that my thing is very connected to sports and wellness because it's quite a universal topic. So it's something that a lot of people I go into a room with, I can find a connection point with them on the thing that we're doing.
Yeah.
But if for instance, you're trying to invest for, I've got quite a few friends who've built Black hair care brands, for instance, or you know, kind of like skin and I guess, wellness brands for black females. If you're going to pitch to a white guy, of course he's going to struggle to understand the concept.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. And also, weirdly, I wonder whether, like, you just won't get the right feedback either, irrespective of the investment decision, because you just don't have anything much in common about the issue in hand.
Exactly. Like, how's he going to relate to the issues we face when we've got Afro hair? Like, he's just not going to understand. Yeah, so like, you're already at such a disadvantage, you know, when you're
particularly in the early stages, right, where so much of that early stage investment is based off of feeling and emotion.
Exactly. And essentially, they back people. That's just, you're just totally right.
Yeah, yeah. Like people's and ideas off of paper. And it's sort of like, oh, I get that problem. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah, all right. Okay, I like you. And then off we go.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's amazing what they did. But I think what's interesting is that they started the fund just after George Floyd. So it was very connected to kind of macro issues and things that they were seeing. And I guess you could say trends. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they're continuing the fund next year. They're deploying the cash into AI. So, yeah, I mean, it's and that is kind of, I guess I would say, it's not a criticism against Google, because I you know, I will never be anything but super grateful for what they've done for Makes us. Sense. But I do think it's emblematic of the way that organizations work and the way that we sometimes follow trends. But this isn't a trend. This is a reality.
Is it like a bit tokenistic? This type of thing without being.
And I think the thing is, like, Google did a lot more, by the way, than anybody else.
Well, yeah, they're the
only other big corporate. I don't know anyone else who's done something like this.
Do you think it's because they're like a bit scared about tackling the issue and talking about the issue? Because there's definitely like, I definitely think in the corporate layer, there's like a bit of concern about, don't want to say the wrong thing, don't want to be seen to be doing the wrong thing, so it's better to not do anything because then no one can criticize you. I don't know if that applies in this case.
I think that the people who drive this initiative on the ground in Google are super passionate about it.
Right.
And this isn't their decision. You know, this comes from above. And I actually think this sat in the kind of PR and marketing budget of Google. That's where it sat. So so that's what you have to think about. You know, what is PRable now? What is marketable now? What's trendy now? You know, from there. That's the way they're thinking about it.
What are some of the most successful businesses that you're aware of, VC-backed businesses founded by black and brown people? Just curious. I'm not a trick question. I'm genuinely curious.
Well, I mean, I'm particularly focused on female founders. But if you look at Emma Greedy, who I don't know if you know her, but she's from Southeast London. She's basically behind all of the Kardashian brands. So she set up Skin.
Oh, wow.
With Kim Kardashian, she set up Good American with Chloe. She set up Safely with Chris. I think her combined value of the companies that she runs with the Kardashians is in excess of $10 billion. And she has recently set up her own family office and is deploying capital into black and brown founders, female founders.
How did she get into that gig?
She's phenomenal. And the thing is, apart from her, I can't tell you one other black or brown female founder who's gone on to really scale a business. There's some of us kind of coming up now whose business is getting to eight figures. But I'd say we're like the first generation of founders who've managed to do that. And we're still few and far between.
Wow. So, yeah. Well, yeah, a lot of work to do. And do you feel like, is this like a conversation? We'll switch on to something else, but I just find this stuff super interesting. Do you have this conversation with actual like mainstream VCs and ask them about this stuff or not really?
Well, I think that amongst my friends, my friend Amber is running a health tech business called R-Grid, and she just raised $7 million, I want to say, for her series A. And I think that is the single biggest raise of a black female founder in the UK ever.
Right.
And I was talking to her about this, and I think the thing that is really challenging is, you know, without begging, you're desperate for the cash.
Right.
When you're trying to scale your business, you're desperate for the cash. And she's gotten a phenomenal business. I think they're doing, you know, seven-figure ARR. She's very successful. Something to do with like automating medical records, I think.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah, it's a big problem to solve.
Yeah, and it's and she's doing phenomenally well, but you also don't want to rock the boat, you know. It's right. Like, it's hard enough to get. Yeah, well, it's hard enough to persuade them. It's
yeah.
Like,
it's do you know what this is the thing? It's like the classic. It's the classic power imbalance, right?
Exactly.
It's like, you know, we work with the NHS a lot, and there's an element about that as well. It's like you don't necessarily want to complain too much about things.
Yeah.
Because then you might get like blacklisted, or they might not take a call, or you know. So it isn't. It's not. It is a bit weird.
It's a challenge for sure. And I think there's a lot we, you know, many of us would want to say. And I think I always say the quickest way for me to have impact in this space is to make my business as successful as possible and then to repay the funds back into the ecosystem and to support other people coming through. And I can't do that unless I build the company to big enough that I have the funds, basically.
Yeah. Amen to that. That sounds like a great philosophy.
And then we're not, you know, we're not worrying about relying on other people. We need to build an ecosystem of ourselves who've built wealth, basically.
And what's like what's the vibe like in kind of the tech scene in Africa at the moment? Because that must, I don't know anything about it, but I imagine it's wild, like super exciting.
I think it's incredible. I mean, I saw some stats because Google do a lot of work there as well.
Because Jack Dorsey was like, Africa's the next big place as well. Like, yeah. That a couple of years ago.
There's so much opportunity there. It's absolutely crazy. And I think there's a lot of people out there doing phenomenal things. But obviously, the ecosystem is just completely different. Like, now. So it's kind of not comparison, but it's a really exciting place. A lot of founders on the fund with us, you know, Nigerian founders, etc., just doing Kenyan founders doing amazing things.
Yeah, it's like a whole it's just sort of I'm not even sure that there's that I even hear about it that much from some of the mainstream European VCs. I'm not sure it's something that's necessarily that really is altogether on their radar. Quick question, slightly on a similar topic. But we, over the last few weeks, we've had a lot of incredible women come on who have been in and around the reproductive health space, particularly whether that be period tracking or menopause or contraception or all kinds of different sort of elements on that continuum. And one of the sort of ongoing discussion points, and it is a discussion, it's not like anyone's come out one way or the other particularly strongly, but like there's at the moment, like there's a number of businesses, women's health businesses that have been founded and are run by men.
Oh my God, yeah.
So
it's
like
such a hot topic in all my founders groups of everyone. Right. Yeah.
So where do you like where do you kind of land on this thing?
Where I land on it is that I think anybody can create a phenomenal business. And interestingly, I went to the US. I got invited to the US to spend some time with this brand called Obvi, OBVI. They're a supplement brand. They went from 0 to 60 million in revenue in 4 years, I think.
Wow.
And they're principally D2C, and they sell supplements for women, right?
Okay.
Middle, principally kind of like 30 to 55 year old women.
Yeah.
And they're like kind of weight loss supplements, their hormonal regulation, all of that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And it's run by three overweight guys, basically. They're this by their own admission. And they don't understand necessarily the consumer, but they are incredible, incredible business people. I mean, I learned so much spending time with them. And so, you know, I think it's complicated to say one way or another. I think anybody should be allowed to create any business as long as they're, you know, behaving properly and putting good back out into the world.
Yeah.
Do I think it becomes a problem when it's blocking others from opportunities and it's blocking others from cash? You know, and if you put, and it kind of goes back to the funding conversation that we just had. If you put the guy running the business and the female running essentially a similar business in front of the VC, often the unconscious bias would drive them towards the guy, which I think is where it becomes a problem. So I don't necessarily think it's about, you know, anybody starting a business. I think it's about access to opportunities again.
Yeah, I think that's what a few of the, I think that's consistent with a lot of what's come up over the last few weeks. It's around like, does it create a distortion in access to investment?
Yeah.
Which then prevents not fair competition, because it's not like anyone's, there's no like monopoly at play here, but it's more like it like distorts the playing field, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right, so we've come up to our final break, so we're going to take 2 minutes and then we're going to come back. I want to hear about let's dig a little bit into what's next for Myomaster. We're like, what's the current, what's next, what's the vision, And then we can touch on, you know, Dragon's Den and stuff like that without, but I just feel like that's probably been done to death a little bit. But, and there might be some more stuff that we can talk about that might be more interesting to you and more exciting. But we'll be back after this short break with my guest this week, Lottie White, the founder of Maya Master.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Lottie White, the founder of MyoMaster. Right, so Lottie, you run or founded MyoMaster with your partner, which is something that I can empathize with, having founded PopDoc with my partner. Like, how have you found that? And then I'll tell you how I found it from my perspective. But what is your, what's like the, you know, the two liner on the whole experience, do you think?
The two liner is beginning phase awful. now much improved and grateful for the opportunity.
Okay, good. I guess my two liner is always like, when it's good, it's awesome, really awesome. And when it's bad, it's really, really yeah. tough. Really tough.
Right.
Yeah. And like not being able to like switch off either. Like work comes home with you the whole time.
But I also think that's a real benefit because I think that running a startup is so all consuming that I always say if I wasn't married to somebody who was also involved in the business, I feel like I might be divorced because they'd just be like,
oh my God,
this is taking up too much of your yeah. time. I don't get it. You know, you're yeah. not present or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, if I have to work 7 days a week, he's like, he understands because he's part of it too.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It's sort of like, you know, you're all in on the whole thing and everyone benefits. So I can't, like, what's even worse though, is like, I can't imagine having just a normal job that you have to do 7 days a week. And then, like, then your partner's being like, what are you doing?
Yeah, well, we did have that for many years before we started the business. And, you know, it's funny because I worked in an ad agency and Joe was a professional rugby player. So like very, and I'm not interested in rugby and he's not really interested in advertising. So, you know, the conversation was definitely not as evolved as it is now. Yeah. And I think it's actually an amazing connection point because yeah. you're doing this thing together. It's a shared dream and a shared vision.
Yeah.
We certainly have lots to talk about.
That is true. One of the things that we've tried really hard to keep a lid on but failed from time to time is sort of like when you disagree with your partner, it's quite difficult to sort of stay within the boundaries of like business, if that makes sense. Like it can like bleed out quite easily into like, and you forgot to do this and you forgot to do that.
Yeah,
like
I mean, I don't think we have, to be totally honest, we don't have that many boundaries. I mean, right. I'd love to say that we like never talk about it when we get home, but like some of our best like conversations are in bed at 2 a.m. Like, oh, did you right. think about this? I've thought about this. Okay. But I think you kind of have to embrace that to a degree because I think that's part of the beauty of it. The key thing for us has just been we have really different roles in the business. It sounds like you guys okay. do too,
yeah,
but we're responsible for very different things and we bring very different skills to the table.
Yeah.
So I think having that clear line about like you own this and I own this is important.
Yeah, I think that's also been helpful from when we've been speaking to investors and things like that to have like those separate roles, you know, so that they can understand, oh, this is not necessarily just like a, you know, man and wife business, which they're not generally so keen on. But yeah, that makes sense. So what's next for MyoMaster? Where are we? What's the vision? Where are we going? What is 2025, 2026? Like,
yes.
What's the vibe on this whole thing?
Yeah, the vibe is the last 2 years have been sensational and we've grown kind of 700% this year.
Wow.
We're one of the fastest growing wellness brands in the UK. And we've really evolved the business from being a sports recovery business, which is kind of the initial iteration of the business. We really sold to kind of athletes into much more of a wellness business. And, you know, we talk about ourselves as wanting to build the home of human optimization. And that's like, how do we give tools, products, and education for people that they can use in their everyday lives to improve their performance and how they feel? Mm-hmm. And so we're approaching it kind of category by category. Right now, we're we're looking at hot cold protocol, and so we've got pictures and ice baths and lots of kind of ancillary products around that, and we share lots of information with our customers about how you can really use those to optimize your overall health. And I think this has been a big jump for us in that a lot of the products we launched at the beginning were very much focused on, okay, you've gone out and done a 10K run, how can you recover your body? And now, you know, when you sell something like ice baths and you're helping to educate people, you understand that whilst there's a lot of physical benefits to cold water immersion, there's a huge amount of mental benefits. And a lot of our customers use the products because they take 5 minutes in their morning and they come out feeling like they've drunk 10 coffees and they can face the day. Yeah. And that's a mental benefit that they need to manage all the things in that, you know, their families, their jobs, all the things they have to struggle in the day and the overwhelmingness of life.
Yeah.
So the next protocol for us after hot and cold, we just released our first sauna, which is sold out.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, which we can't keep in stock. And we've got another couple of versions coming out, different types of saunas coming out to cater for all of our customers. And after that, we're really looking at sleep as a project, what kind of products we can give you to help improve that. Because obviously, you know, all of the stuff we're selling is great, but if you're not having a good night's sleep, none of it really means anything.
And like this, did this kind of, because what you've done, it sounds like, or are doing, is like evolving from a simple business that sells products to people to service needs, specific tight needs, like, oh, I went on a run, my muscles hurt, I need to solve that, into almost like a pathway provider to improve your health, focused on specific channels. Like, did that insight come out of like customer feedback? Did it come out of like market scanning? Did it come out, how did that kind of evolve, that insight? Because you could have just carried on flogging product.
Yeah, no, for sure. So we the first 6 months before COVID, and then when COVID finished and shows came back and races came back, we literally spent every single weekend, and I'm not exaggerating, my mum's in the background, she was very often looking after my son.
thanks grandma.
But yeah, exactly. But most weekends we were packing up, and either we would sit at the end of a race or I do a recovery hub for people, or we'd go to shows, like the running show, whatever. And when we would just have thousands of conversations with people, basically, and we start to understand, like, okay, you're a runner, but also you have all of these other challenges that you're facing in your life. And our core customer is really sort of like 32 to 55 years old. They are in that phase of their life where they're starting to think about their health, because things start to go wrong with your body in a way that you don't feel in your 20s, or you're not.
Unfortunately, I can attest to that.
No, most often. And they're very time poor because they do have kids and they have busy jobs, and they're looking for things that can make a significant difference to how they feel, but don't require a huge amount of time for them and are easy for them to incorporate into their lives. And so the evolution of the brand really came from us being out on the ground and talking to our target customer and realizing that even if they did love running marathons, you know, two or three times a year, there was so much more that they were thinking about in terms of like their wellness and their overall performance. And really their goal is always, how do I wake up every day and deliver the best of my ability at all the roles and responsibilities that I have in my life, you know?
And I think the other thing, which I'm not sure if I've got this down correctly, and I might express it slightly clumsily, but you seem to be interested in providing really quality products that deliver a really high level of value, but remain within what would be considered to be somewhat affordable, if that makes sense. You know where I'm kind of getting at.
You have to be cautious about that, right? Because everything's relative. And I.
Yes, exactly. Always, I'm being slightly careful with how I say things.
Yeah. I'm always really conscious when I say that we kind of pride ourselves on affordability, because it's relative.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, we talk about that in the context of the broader market. And for us, it's like, we never want to compromise on quality, but this really has been driven by Joe, my co-founder, to be honest, who was an elite athlete at the, you know, top of his game. He played for his country. And he was seeing and getting access to products and tools that were helping him. But if he wanted to buy them, it was like £4,000 or £5,000. And he was like, I can't afford to pay those prices. So if I'm, this is my job and I have to think about my body and peak performance every day, then what is everybody else feeling like? And so, you know, we always wanted to bring it to price. That's why when we look at saunas, for instance, we're bringing out three different saunas and they're all at different price points so that we hope everybody in our customer base will be able to get access to it, to one of the versions, so they can have access to the practical.
And I think that that's a really interesting, like, that's way more than just creating something to sell product. It's like you're creating access.
Yeah, I hope so. That's definitely. Well,
but I think that's how it becomes more than just that, how it becomes a movement, you know, like a platform for that stuff, which I think is really inspiring. I also know I started doing cold water swimming a couple of years ago. And like 18 months ago. I love it. I think, it, like you said, it's like the best thing for your mental health. Yeah. And the thing I like about it is, like, I really don't like doing it. Like, it's a really hard thing to actually get over the hump of actually going in. And then it sets you up for the day because you know you've already done something like really, really hard that was really difficult to do. And you actually just followed through and did it.
I think that's such, like, that's something we hear over and over again is, like, above the benefits, winning the start of your day or forcing yourself to do something, even if you're in there for 2 minutes, you know, the very act of, especially in this kind of weather, the very act of doing something that feels uncomfortable and doesn't feel, you know, innate or feels kind of anti what you want to do is a really powerful thing for people and has changed people's mindsets. And like some of the feedback we get, it's really changed people's lives.
Yeah, no, I look, it's absolutely revolutionized. Well, revolutionized my life a little bit strong. It's changed my perception on quite a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So I've always been quite sporty, Ironman, triathlon, all that kind of, you know, jazz. But it's something that I really, really get a huge amount of benefit from. Mm. I'm lucky I live near a lake, so I can go do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were in Lapland this last week with kids, which was phenomenal. And we did the Finnish sauna next to the hole in the ice. So you went from like the 0 degree water into the sauna and then back.
Wow.
And we got
that
the kids.
That's their whole jam, which we're trying to kind of recreate for UK gardens.
Well, no, but I think that's but apart from the health benefits, like the actual, the almost like the experiential nature of it was really, really, really powerful. And like, we got the kids doing it and stuff.
Wow.
Like, we got the 5-year-old in the 0 degree thing. And I know, I feel like it's around that access issue, which is like, it's not possible or feasible to go to Finland.
Right.
Right. But like, actually there's still a huge amount of benefit from that. And you're kind of putting that together, which I think is fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I guess in the last part of the show, we've got 5 minutes left. Well, more like 3 or 4 before the producer cuts it that we have to kind of finish. But the I like to use this like a time to just sort of like work with or talk to the guest and like reflect a little bit about like what have some of the mottos or not or phrases or mindsets that you've relied on your journey that you might want to like pass on to the people listening who may or may not be going through something similar or thinking about it or whatever. But basically, what has it gotten you know, like you said, it's all difficult. It's always hard. So what has kind of kept you going?
I think one of the phrases I love is, if you don't quit, you will win. And I think so much of this journey about starting a company or anything that you're trying to achieve, so much of it is just about staying the course. And, you know, a lot of people say that, or founders fail or entrepreneurs fail because they run out of money. And a couple of like other traditional reasons. But I really believe that like, if you just keep getting up every day and you keep showing up and you keep giving it your best, like eventually you will win. And that's certainly been true of my journey. It wasn't like straight out the gate, this thing went phenomenally well and it's never stopped since. You know, had a hard couple of years where I wanted to quit basically every day.
Yeah.
I couldn't see the wood for the trees. And I'm like, oh, we're finally starting to see some success now. And I'm sure that will ebb and flow. But I think there's so much power in just staying the course, basically.
And like, what kept you going? What kept you not quitting every day when you wanted to quit?
Honestly, probably just my ego. Probably just like, you know, I wasn't going to be the person that failed. And like, yeah, just like, I don't want to give up. I don't want to fail. So,
yeah. And do you feel like it's your background in sports that or were you just like that anyway? Like it's connected?
I think I've got a bit of a chip on my shoulder and I've got a point to prove. So you know, and I'd had this conversation with someone recently about that. I think most entrepreneurs, you know, either are like deeply insecure or were when they started, or they've had some trauma in their, you know, background. And as a result, they've got this, they have to do this thing. And yeah. I think that drives maybe every entrepreneur I've ever met has some kind of story like that. And certainly for me, it's like, I've got a point to prove. That's And I want to, and I'm proud that I get to, you know, wake up every day and do something I think that puts good out into the world. I'm sure you feel the same. I don't know how I'd feel about doing something that wasn't as kind of positive for people. Yeah. But yeah, I've got a point to prove.
I think, I mean, the thing for me is like, I'm a huge believer in the power of the mission, whatever the mission is, you know, and it's personal to whoever and it's different. And some people feel really strongly about one thing versus another. But I think if your mission is big enough and your so what is big enough, that can get you a really, really, really long way. You know, and for me, I agree with you. I mean, I've got, there's a particular reason that I do what I do, you know, and it's a lot of entrepreneurs have a similar thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's just something that's happened that just makes us look differently at the same set of circumstances
mm-hmm.
from somebody else and just kind of want to just run through brick walls.
Exactly.
Exactly. So we've come to the end of the show.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for coming on. I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about Stephen Bartlett, but I hope that's okay. you know, really appreciate you coming on. And thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, hold on. Where do people go if they want to get any of your products?
Yeah, head to MyoMaster, MyoMaster.com, and you can shop everything there. They're amazing Christmas presents.
I can confirm that. And there's a very lucky person in my family that will be getting something, which I'm not gonna spill the beans on. But yeah. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. Thanks for coming on, Lottie. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.